Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
We leveraged our resources with our overseas partners and pulled out all the stops because it was the Office of the Deputy Secretary of Defense. It was an important request. And the answer came back, no, that there was no link that could be found. And this was relayed back to the office, and we thought that was the end of it. That sad but true saying that peace is bad for business, and, you know, the military-industrial complex may not be serving our national interests, but it definitely serves corporate interests. And, of course, you've got that revolving door between government folks and military folks and the CEOs of many of these corporations like Lockheed and others that just make in the billions and trillions from these amazing contracts.
This week on Tell Somebody, Elizabeth Murray talks about her CIA career and her anti-nuclear activism. This is Tom Clammer. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Welcome to the Tell Somebody podcast for January 21st, 2016. This podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the Tell Somebody broadcast heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City. Look for Tell Somebody online at www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter at Tell Somebody Now, and like the Facebook page, www.facebook.com/tellsomebodynow. This is your host, Tom Clammer. I first noticed Elizabeth Murray as author of articles at consortiumnews.com and as one of the signers of letters coming from Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS, the organization co-founded by Ray McGovern shortly before the illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq. And last fall, I found links to videos at raymcgovern.com showing Murray with McGovern on a speaking tour in Germany. Elizabeth Murray served as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for the Near East in the National Intelligence Council before retiring after a 27-year career in the U.S. government. She is a member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and has been involved with Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, www.gzcenter.org, since 2012. I reached her on the phone and recorded this conversation. Give a listen. Elizabeth Murray, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Tom.
I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself, your education, and how did you end up working for the CIA?
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting story because I actually had a very modest education. I have just a bachelor's degree from New Mexico State University. I graduated in German and in journalism. I had a double major, and my first job right out of college was as a newspaper reporter. But the thing is, I had traveled extensively in my childhood and my teen years to Germany and grew up in Panama and different places and started to get a little itchy over there in southwestern New Mexico working for a daily and making $9,000 a year, even back in 1982, was a little bit limiting. So I started to think about, wouldn't it be great to work overseas? And so I found out about this organization called FBIS, or the Foreign Broadcast Information Service, that was looking for editors to edit at U.S. embassies overseas. And so I applied, and it was only later when the response came back on a letterhead that said Central Intelligence Agency did I realize what I was in for. And, you know, I had mixed feelings, but at the same time I thought, you know, this would be great experience. I could travel. The idea of international travel really appealed to me. And then plus this organization, FBIS, as it was called then, which is now called the Open Source Center, is actually the CIA's open source arm. All they do is monitor open source media, news from, you know, newspapers, radio broadcasts, TV, that get translated from their original language into English, and then they need editors and analysts to put them together, and it's, you know, leader speeches and political commentaries and interesting things to give to our policymakers to help them make better decisions about foreign policy. So I just jumped right in. I thought that it was great. And so that's what I did for the first 20 years of my, you know, and I'll say CIA just in quotes, because for the first 20 years I worked exclusively on the open source side of the CIA before I jumped into being sort of an all-source analyst and working as sort of a traditional intelligence analyst. And so it was, I mean, I thought, well, you know, it's not that big of a jump from newspaper work into editing and helping to educate our policymakers. So that's how it started, innocently enough, with initially no idea that that organization came under the umbrella of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Since they sent me to places like London and to the Middle East and to Cyprus and stuff, I just, you know, I jumped at the opportunity to learn about, you know, foreign languages and cultures. And while I was there working during these 20 years, I was able to learn the Arabic language well before 9/11 struck. And so I really was well-placed career-wise when things heated up after 9/11.
And were you, like, based in D.C. and then traveling from there, or where did you live?
That's exactly right. I lived and worked in Northern Virginia, and, I mean, close enough that you would call it the D.C. Metropolitan area, and, yeah, and just did several long-term overseas assignments, basically one after the other, that kept my life really interesting. It was almost like getting a graduate degree while working, you know, learning about different perspectives on U.S. policies by reading these editorials, reading speeches. When I was in England, we monitored the speeches of Mikhail Gorbachev during the opening of the Soviet Union under the perestroika, glasnost era. We also monitored the speeches of Colonel Gaddafi, and this was in the early 1980s. I mean, it was very heady stuff. It was really fascinating and, quite frankly, very educational for me.
And paint a little picture, if you could, for us on, say, you go to England. How long do you stay typically? What are your daily activities?
Right. So my initial assignments before I became an analyst were editorial. And in those days, and probably still to some extent today, the open source officer basically works in tandem with the foreign staff that is skilled in the quick turnover translation of whatever foreign news and editorials we've judged to be politically significant. They then translate it, and it then comes to my desk, or in this case it would be over a computer screen, although back in the 80s we still used paper, and we had wooden inboxes and rubber stamps and things like that. But in any case, I would read it over for readability to make sure that the English was proper. I had a very good facility in the English language. I always did, so it was very easy for me. And I was already had, in those days, they really wanted people who had some foreign language expertise, and I was fluent in German at the time. before I learned Arabic later. So I already knew kind of what the difficulties might be in translating and what some of the problems might be. And so I came to it with a fairly good international background. And so we would also, before they were even translated, we would decide what needed to be translated. And basically we had the routine items, basically economic stuff or low-level political stuff, and then we had items that were deemed priority, which were deemed of more urgent interest, and that went on up immediate or flash items, which, you had to send really quickly to the policymakers. And a flash item, an example for that may have been, for example, in the 1960s when word came that Nikita Khrushchev had decided to withdraw the missiles from Cuba. That would be a flash-level thing. So it was a pretty exciting place to work in that sense, right on the cusp of the news.
And you were in a CIA office somewhere in London?
Actually, we were 40 miles west of London. We worked in tandem with a British monitoring agency and actually shared some of their translators, and we have a partnership with the UK in sharing the resources that we have with translators and such, so that they can provide their government with similar editorial data and analytical data. So we were west of London, sort of in a nice bucolic countryside in an old manor house. So it was quite the experience for someone in their early 20s, as I was at the time.
I bet. And roughly similar setup in other countries you visited?
In other countries, we often worked either in the embassy or in sort of an annex adjacent to the embassy. My experience most of the time in embassies, and there were a few other places that did have separate installations, and we were widely known by the local population and in these countries that that's the place where they do monitoring and translations. We were openly declared to the government because even though we were technically CIA, nothing we were doing was really secret. I mean, all we were doing was translating news that was totally available to the public but might not be available, to American policymakers unless it was translated. So it was pretty important work, and we took pride in our work.
And how did things evolve to where you were and what you were doing around the time of 9/11?
Oh, gosh. That's an interesting story. At 9/11, I was actually in the D.C. area, and I was on a rotational assignment to the National Intelligence Council, which is a separate agency but actually works under the same roof as the CIA and is kind of a clearinghouse for intelligence assessment for all around the intelligence community. I was working there. I had just started my assignment it was 2001. So, and then when 9/11 happened, my home office which was back at the Open Source Center, which is, as I mentioned earlier, the newer name for what was previously the Foreign Broadcast Information Service, the government's open source arm, essentially, they immediately recalled me and said, "We need you back. We need all Arabic language capable folks." And what had happened was the year prior, I had convinced my office to send me for full-time Arabic language training. And as you may recall from that time, the CIA had a really big shortage of language-capable folks, and I was one of them that had enough. I wasn't perfect in Arabic, but I was certainly enough to be a valuable resource to my home office. So my rotational assignment was cut short. I was yanked back, and I became actually in charge at that time of the Iraqi media section. And it was then, sort of in the years following 9/11, that my work became increasingly more important as the U.S. government sought to build up a rationale for striking Iraq. And they then tried to use me as an appendage to help support their argument or their allegation that there was a link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, and I can tell you that story if you like.
Yes, I think I've heard that you were contacted by Mr. Wolfowitz's office. We'd love to hear all about that.
Correct, yeah. I was in charge of Iraqi media analysis at the Open Source Center at the time, and we received a call in early 2003. This was before the March 2003 launch of the U.S. attack on Iraq, asking us for proof in Iraqi media of this link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda that was being alleged by this office. And this was sort of news to me, and I thought, well, okay, well, we'll check it out, and we did, and we leveraged our resources with our overseas partners and pulled out all the stops because it was the Office of the Deputy Secretary of Defense. It was an important request. And the answer came back, no, that there was no link that could be found, and this was relayed back to the office, and we thought that was the end of it, but 2 weeks later, the same request came back, clearly with an implication that we hadn't done our job correctly the first time, and so we redoubled our efforts, and again, the answer came back, absolutely no evidence of any link between Saddam and al-Qaeda. And several weeks later, they came back again with the implication that the answer we had given them was wrong. And so at this point, I really got a little bit angry at the situation. I thought, well, you know, do they not think we're doing our job correctly? So I phoned up the office personally and asked the person who answered the phone in the office, could they please check with their superiors and find out where this allegation came from, what the source was, because perhaps that would help us track it down better, that we were not able to find any evidence of this. And, of course, as you may have heard from my previous talks, there was never any response to my request. And we, of course, found out in 2006 officially that there was no link between it, and it was simply one of many pretexts that the administration was seeking to try to sell the war to the American people. So basically, I mean, you can imagine the waste of the taxpayers using all those resources to go on a wild goose chase when it was all false. Now, of course, others were pressured to come up with false information and did under different circumstances, including al-Libi, who was someone who was kidnapped and rendered and tortured until he confessed that, yes, he was tortured in Egypt, and he finally confessed that, yes, he was sending al-Qaeda folks over to Iraq and training folks and that sort of thing. And, of course, you know, people say that torture works, and, well, it does in the sense that you can get people to say just about anything you want as long as you promise that the torture will stop. And that's basically what happened to al-Libi, and he was later killed. He was basically someone who knew too much, and he was disappeared, unfortunately, in that mysterious morass of foreign prisons where people just are not heard from again. But, you know, it was this kind of this was really the first event, this run-in with Wolfowitz's office, which made me start to wonder, is this really an organization that I want to be part of? And I really felt that our office at the Open Source Center was being dragged into this politicization, that we were being asked to do things that were simply political in nature and had no basis in giving the facts and information to, accurate facts to our policymakers that would help them make the right decision. And, of course, it was around this time that you may also recall that Ray McGovern founded Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity well before I was involved in the organization, and the group put out a letter to the U.S. administration asking George Bush basically to widen his circle of advisors because he might be getting the wrong information about Iraq's alleged ties to al-Qaeda, et cetera. And unfortunately, that advice was not heeded, and the rest is history.
Yes, and I don't know, was that VIPS thing the same as the response to Colin Powell's UN speech or something even earlier than that?
No, that's actually one and the same, Tom. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. And what was your sense, both professionally and just as a citizen, leading up to Shock and Awe, and you've gotten it touched on that at least, but, you know, I hear all these politicians nowadays saying, if we knew then what we know now, maybe we wouldn't have done that. And, you know, a lot of us felt like we did know then. I pulled up something I read on the air two or three days before Shock and Awe, expressing a lot of doubt that I'd heard about. There was a lot of public wanting to kick some ass. There was also a lot of public that was very skeptical, and I think there was some reason to be. What are your memories of those days or couple of weeks before that?
I can remember just not believing that this country was going to go to war, because it seemed so clear to me, from my own ability inside, inside the CIA to be able to look. Obviously, I had access to a lot of classified information, so, you know, it is true that I could see things that most Americans couldn't. But at the same time, I mean, from everything people were being told in the media, so much of it was just seemed like static and hyperbole and very little substance. And I just thought to myself, you know, with all the international clamor against war, all the demonstrations, which I actually I joined the wave of demonstrations in Washington D.C. against the war in the run up to the war. They had begun in 2002 and went all the way up to the unbelievable day when Shock and Awe was launched. But my honest answer to you, as I can recall, Tom, is that I honestly did not believe it was going to happen. I really thought that truth and reason were going to prevail, because the stakes were too high, the human cost was too high. We knew Saddam Hussein well. Our government had done business with him for years. I mean, he had been our ally until until several things happened, including apparently he wanted to change the primary currency for purchasing oil from the dollar to the euro, and I guess there were other issues that later came up that I'm sure that wasn't the only thing, but they decided, I guess, that they could do without him. But he had been a U.S. ally for so long, and I just really thought that things could be worked out diplomatically, and it seemed that, you know, many people around the world felt that diplomacy would prevail. But, of course, there was this 2002 national intelligence estimate that came out that sort of intimated that Iraq, you know, was working toward WMDs. I mean, that didn't help matter. And I think that was an example of the kind of politicization and basically, you know, manufacturing of intelligence that took place under tremendous political pressure. There was obviously an administration agenda to go to war. And it was, it must have been very frustrating for everyone involved in war resistance at the time, because despite the overwhelming resistance by so many, I think there were 100,000 people that demonstrated in London, for example, but just in every capital city in the world, that this went forward anyway, extremely sobering and frightening reminder of what a great power can do, right or wrong. Another anecdote I can add was that in the run up to this war, when the drumbeat had already begun, I was invited to participate in war games. And the subject of the war games, this took place in November of 2002, the subject of the war games was the aftermath of a hypothetical, quote-unquote, attack against Iraq. What would Iraq look like afterward? And, you know, we explored scenarios such as, you know, was it going to be divided into into three different states, you know, Sunni and Shia and Christian or Chaldean or whatever, and various different scenarios were played out. And this was a three-day war game that was up at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And I can still remember on the third day, we were all sitting in a big auditorium going over the final results and assessments. And there was an Iraqi-American gentleman sitting next to me. He was the spouse of one of the American professors present. And he was wearing dark glasses, but I could still see that there were tears coming down his cheeks. Now, I remember this very distinctly. I turned to him and whispered, "Excuse me, sir, is there something wrong? Is there anything I can do?" And he just leaned over and whispered to me, "Everyone here is discussing military issues and strategic issues and political issues, and no one is talking about the thousands or maybe hundreds of thousands of people, my people, that are going to die in this war."
Wow.
And exactly, and those comments just made me freeze all over, and I felt paralyzed totally for a moment, and I thought to myself, he's right, and what are we all doing here? Who are we? Why are we not talking about the human cost of this adventure? Which, I mean, at the time, I still was in denial that it would ever happen. But that episode was another sort of marker for me that made me really question, do I really belong in this, excuse me, do I really belong in this circle, in this environment?
Yeah.
And there was nothing I could do I tried to think of something to console him, to make him feel better, but his message really hit home.
And boy, was he right.
Indeed.
And, you know, just speaking as a layman here, of course, but it's hard for me to realize that there was some sort of war game looking at the aftermath of invasion, if I got you right, and then look at how the aftermath was managed, how the entire Iraqi military was unemployed and time and weapons on their hands. I mean, isn't that a pretty big disconnect there, or is that just me?
No, it is a pretty big disconnect, and this was only a three-day war game. It was a
sure.
Superficial role play by people who were not military experts. They were basically volunteer intelligence analysts from various parts of the intelligence community, and I think it was kind of a very sort of post-Iraq light, if you will. In other words, I do believe that there must not have been any serious consideration given to managing the situation after the U.S. forces put their boots on the ground there, because, I mean, we're seeing that the violence has just gotten worse and worse, and of course, you know, billions of dollars unaccounted for that were supposed to repair the infrastructure in Iraq, and all these companies, including the Blackwater mercenaries, but certainly the Beltway bandits like CACI, who were involved in the activities at Abu Ghraib prison, the many people who are supposedly the companies involved in building up the infrastructure, just, you know, running away with a killing. And I think that as far as I know, there are still problems with basic things in Iraq like sewage and pure water and electricity, despite these billions. So not just incompetence, but tremendous corruption in this military corporate takeover.
Yeah, and I just flashed back for a second to Gulf War I, or maybe shortly before it, and Saddam Hussein had captured some Americans, and I don't remember the details. I think they were civilians, but the outrage here in the States that he put them on television. Now, to my knowledge, they weren't mistreated at all in any other way. They didn't have their heads cut off, nor were they stripped naked and made to wear dog collars and do strange things to each other. But this horrible dictator put them on television. And
this outraged America, and look what we've done since.
Yeah. No, I remember that very well, too, now that you mention it. And I do remember that. I believe that there was a pilot who did sort of have black and blue eyes and that sort of thing. I don't think the Iraqis could be called saints, but certainly nothing in comparison to what we inflicted on innocent Iraqis, not just in the torture and mistreatment in Abu Ghraib, but just in bombing itself and what we like to call collateral damage. So, absolutely no comparison at all. And besides, these people were all released in decent shape and such. So, I do remember that. And, in fact, I was serving in the Middle East at the time of the first Gulf War, and we didn't know where Saddam's Scuds were going to land, so we had to evacuate our office where we were monitoring his speeches in Amman, Jordan, and they flew us out to a similar facility that we had in Nicosia, Cyprus, and we spent the duration of the war there until Saddam declared that he was going to withdraw his troops, and I believe that was in April of 1991. I think that's correct. But, very much sticks in my memory as well.
Yeah. So, shock and awe, and you were then Deputy National Intelligence Officer and in the National Intelligence Council, is that right? And what did that mean? What were your duties?
Actually, let me just correct you, if I may, Tom.
Sure.
During shock and awe, I was still at the Open Source Center in charge of Iraqi media. When I became Deputy National Intelligence Officer of the Near East, I was actually very close to retiring at the time. I believe, between 2009 and 2010. But to get back to your question, my duties were to, I actually looked at both draft estimates for Iraq initially, and then I was moved over to the Iran account. But it wasn't as exciting as you might think, because I was particularly focused on internal Iranian developments. The National Intelligence Council has a separate office for the nuclear file, where they would have looked at sort of, you know, any allegations of Iranian nuclear activity, and all the interesting political stuff that was going around that was in someone else's office. But my particular duties were looking at what was happening in following the June 2009 elections in Iran, in which, you know, there was the so-called Green Revolution, where Ahmadinejad prevailed, and there were allegations of voter fraud and all that sort of thing. And I was primarily involved in looking at political and social developments inside Iran at the time, and I was also involved in pulling various members of the intelligence community together to start drafting a national intelligence estimate on internal developments in Iran, although I did leave my position before that NIA was completed, so I couldn't take credit for anything, you know, any of those documents that came out later. But it was a very interesting job. I was able to really leverage my 20-plus years of skills and even my Arabic language skills, looking at other issues also in Iraq and in Israel-Palestine. Lots of different Middle Eastern countries came under my file, but I was in the end finally given the Iran file for a brief period before. I'm actually similar to your situation in that the chief reason for my retirement was actually I was put in a caregiving situation, and my mother needed urgent surgery, and then she needed care at home. And this was all happening in early 2010. And when it became apparent that she couldn't do it on her own and she needed someone, it happened to be just the same year that I was, the first year that I was able to retire. So I took what you might consider an early retirement, slightly reduced pension, but I was able to retire at 50 back in 2010, care for my mom for a year, and then after she recovered, that was then when I went north to Washington State and started getting involved in the peace movement full time. So.
This is Tom Clammer. We've been talking to Elizabeth Murray, formerly with the CIA, and we want to get back to that right after you listen to this.
What if we had more hard-hitting journalism, more local stories, more quality kids' shows, more independent voices?
What if we had more people telling their friends about the vital information they hear on KKFI? What if we had more listeners supporting community radio in Kansas City and the surrounding area? Most of the nearly 2 million people our 100,000-watt transmitter can reach have never heard of us. What if more people helped us get more hard-hitting journalism and more local stories on the air on KKFI? What if more people realized the potential of KKFI and got involved in trying to reach that potential?
What if we had less celebrity fluff, less mind-numbing advertising, less partisan shouting, less junk TV? We need more public media, better public media, new public media, now.
Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is Tom Clammer, and we've been talking to former CIA analyst Elizabeth Murray, and right before the break she was talking about how she took early retirement, caregiver for her mother, and became something of an activist. Is that right?
Yes, I ended up becoming a full-time nuclear resistance activist once I moved over to Washington State and started participating in actions associated with the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action. And I'm currently member in residence at the Ground Zero Center.
And tell us a bit about what is the Ground Zero Center. This is an organization that's been around for a few years in Washington State?
Yes, that's correct, Tom. The Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action was founded back in 1977 in response to the news that the Navy was going to build and station the Trident nuclear submarines right at the Kitsap Bangor Naval Base, and there was a groundswell of concern. This was during the Cold War, obviously, in the 70s, and there was a lot of concern that this could lead to a nuclear conflagration with the Soviet Union. So the center was founded on 3.8 acres that were actually communally purchased by a group of activists, and that acreage is significant because it's actually located adjacent to Naval Base Kitsap Bangor. In fact, we share a border fence with them, and just on the other side of the fence is the naval base. We focus on the abolition of nuclear weapons through nonviolent direct action. We have a website at www.gzcenter.org. We have a Facebook, and we have a quarterly newsletter. We also host 3 actions per year right at the center, although this year, I should say, we're about to do our Martin Luther King Day action. We've decided to take the action over to Seattle, which is about 20 miles east of us. We're actually close to the Olympic Peninsula, and we're about a 30-minute ferry ride from Seattle. But back to our actions, we do one every Martin Luther King Day in January. We celebrate Mother's Day, which some people may know that Mother's Day was an anti-war holiday, and we also commemorate the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August, 3-day retreat at the Ground Zero Center. the Trident submarine base that we are engaged in nonviolent resistance with currently has the largest concentration of nuclear weapons in the United States. Many people may not be aware that more than over 25% of our nation's nuclear weapons, which is about 1,500 nuclear warheads, are deployed at the Bangor base. There are 8 Trident submarines at Bangor. Each submarine is presently deployed with about 100 nuclear warheads. Each of those warheads has the capability of creating the equivalent of 6 Hiroshimas. These submarines are on hair trigger alert when they're at sea. Usually there are at least 6 of them out deploying at any given time. They're ready to launch on command. The warheads at Bangor are either the W76-100 kiloton warhead or the W88-455 kiloton warhead. And we're currently focused on a program to defund a $100 billion replacement submarine program at Bangor. Right now, within the next 10 years, the Navy is planning to start a replacement missile program on top of the replacement submarine program. That is, in addition to the $100 billion it's going to cost to build 12 new submarines, it's going to cost another $40 to $50 billion on top of this for a replacement missile. So we work actively. We leaflet the base at least once a month. We have the privilege of several former base employees as being among our most strident activists. We even have a former submarine commander who is part of the Ground Zero Center. There are a lot of interesting stories of transformation and conversion among people who have been in a position to know what an incredible danger this program poses to the United States, and especially to the people, the population over in Seattle, where any kind of nuclear mishap or accident could send clouds of radiation to do untold damage to the population there.
Well, hey, we got to defend ourselves, right?
Well, that's what we're told, but the Cold War has been over for a long time, and as far as I know, the ISIS and Al-Qaeda, et cetera, are not really in the nuclear game. So theoretically, we're trying to keep up with Russia and China. But again, if each of these nuclear warheads can do 6 Hiroshimas, why do we need 12 new submarines?
Yes, with the Cold War over, I remember at the breakup of the Soviet Union, there was all this talk about the peace dividend. That never materialized, and we got the terrorist boogeyman to replace the Soviet boogeyman, but neocons are flirting with another Cold War, if we're not already in it, with Russia over Ukraine and other issues.
Well, indeed, and let's not forget also the U.S. pivot toward China in the Pacific. Currently, more than 60% of nuclear submarine patrols are taking place in the Pacific Ocean, and there is active nuclear war planning against China, North Korea, as well as Russia. So there are several areas of concern, and I was actually privileged to visit the South Korean island of Jeju, where the finishing touches are being placed on a Navy base that will be able to port U.S. ships with and submarines with nuclear weapons. So it's getting more frightening as the stakes rise. And again, you know, these submarines are on hair trigger alert, so you have to wonder what could happen if there's a false alarm or some kind of malfunction. And, you know, how safe does this really make us? I mean, how can the overwhelming obliteration of people that a nuclear attack would almost certainly make happen, how can that be just, proportional, or achieve a greater good? Most of us who are in the nuclear movement are convinced that, especially after Hiroshima, the world is really left with two choices. There can be a nonviolent path to disarmament or a violent path toward an eventual nuclear holocaust.
Yeah. And I might mention for our listeners, I just earlier today read a piece you wrote about this Korean island at consortiumnews.com, the island of, is it Jeju?
That's correct, yes.
And if you go to consortiumnews.com and put Elizabeth Murray in the search box, that should pop right up along with several other of your articles. Pretty interesting stuff. And backing up just a little bit, if I drop in from Mars a while back and had my antenna up for Trident submarines, I would probably hear something about Washington and something about British submarines in Scotland. What's the relationship there?
Right. I'm not actually completely versed in how many are in the in Fastlane Scotland, but we do have a sister nuclear resistance movement in Scotland that are, they're actually a lot more active than we are. And as far as I know, Lockheed Martin and other groups that they manufacture the warheads that will be fit onto the Tridents over there too. Scotland is just one of several other places where nuclear weapons are, U.S. nuclear weapons are being deployed. But the other counterpart to the Ground Zero Center is over on the Atlantic side. There are six Trident submarines in Kings Bay, Georgia. And in fact, there's a small, group there that I just actually joined. They, every New Year's, they have a vigil at the base over there in Kings Bay to express resistance, peaceful resistance against the presence of the six nuclear submarines. And these are routinely deployed with their full missile loadings, which again can be quite it's quite frightening when you think about what their power is and how quickly they could send a payload and destroy hundreds of thousands of people. So this is really something. Another thing, if I could just walk back for a minute about
sure.
the beginnings of Ground Zero, you might be interested to know that the whole nonviolent campaign against Trident began when a gentleman who worked for Lockheed Martin, or at the time I guess it was just called Lockheed, he was one of the designers of the Trident missile in the mid-1970s. His name was Robert Aldridge. He ended up resigning his job in the 70s when he was working on the reentry vehicle for Trident missiles and realized that the new missile system that he was working on was being designed for a first strike capability. And that really scared him. And so he had a wife and five children, I think, and he obviously had a good salary, and he gathered his whole family together at a little retreat somewhere off in the country, and he told them that his conscience was really bothering him and that this weapon that he was working on would just kill massive amounts of innocent civilians and even on a first strike, in other words, without provocation. And all his children agreed that Dad should do what his conscience told him to do and leave his job. So Bob Aldridge, who's still with us and lives in California, is retired, left his job, stayed at home, learned to cook and clean at home. His wife went out and got a job, and all of his children ended up going to college and doing really well. And I saw them last year. We all went to a conference in Northern California. It's called the Pacific Life Community. It's a community that was formed, again, to oppose Trident. And he's just an example for people who say, well, I can't leave this job because the money's too good. he managed and his family thrived. And the Ground Zero Center is actually full of people with stories like that. We have another person named Mona Lee, who used to work full-time at the Bangor Naval Base until she came up right up against a missile and had an opportunity to reach out and touch it with her hand. And she said at that moment, it just came to her, my God, I could be the one that pushes that button and helps with the obliteration of God knows how many people. And so she had to resign, and she had to deal with a couple of dead-end jobs until she finally reinvented herself and found another career. But she did what her conscience dictated, and she's thriving and still with us as an activist. She's in her 70s now, and we have a core group led by about 24 people who, of course, are still committed to the nonviolent resistance even after 30 years. We meet there as a community about once a month and sponsor various outreach activities with the community, and try to find common cause with many of our neighbors who work at the base and have their economic means from the base. But at the same time, I personally, as someone who leaflets, I'm so impressed with the number of people who will say to me as I hand out leaflets, keep doing what you're doing. We're so glad you're here. Thank you, thank you. It's not everyone is ready or in a position to join us. You know, we understand that people have families to raise and that sort of thing, but there is this undercurrent of support that's always been there. And in fact, when I was leafleting at Kings Bay, Georgia, over on the our East Coast Trident Resistance folks, even a policeman came up to me, and when I offered him a leaflet, he said, "Ma'am, I'm not allowed to accept it, but I hope that what you're doing makes the difference."
Wow, that'll keep you going a little bit, won't it?
It was really inspiring. I mean, just these kind of things that you would never expect will suddenly happen, and you're right, Tom, it does keep us going.
And maybe we should hook you up with some Kansas City folks. You know, you're talking about huge expenses for new submarines, and Kansas City activists, at least, are well aware that the production side of the nuclear weapons complex facilities, including a brand new close to $1 billion nuclear weapons parts plant just opened in Kansas City about a year and a half ago, I guess it was. Huge spending for new facilities and improvements, you know, supposedly just kind of maintenance type stuff, but a lot of money making the bombs more accurate, as I understand it. But as, you know, we're nearly a quarter of a century past the breakup of the Soviet Union and under a president who won the Nobel Peace Prize coming in, all this is going on. This is kind of disturbing.
Yeah, and I like to go back to, you know, that sad but true saying that peace is bad for business, and, you know, the military-industrial complex may not be serving our national interests, but it definitely serves corporate interests. And, of course, you've got that revolving door between government folks and military folks and the CEOs of many of these corporations like Lockheed and others that just make in the billions and trillions from these amazing contracts. And I like to, if I may, quote Eisenhower's 1961 farewell address, which he said, "In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist," end quote.
Yeah. I think, unfortunately, I could go on, but time is about up. But in the final minute or so, any final thoughts, information you want to leave with our listeners before we let you go?
I just want to quote the words of Archbishop Raymond Hunthausen, who was a former Archbishop of Seattle and who visited the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action in 1978 and 1982, made a landmark speech that shook the Vatican when he invited all Americans to engage in tax resistance and not to pay the 50% or 60% part of their taxes now that go toward military spending. And the statement that he made when he made a speech in 1981 at Seattle's Pacific Lutheran University was that Trident is the Auschwitz of Puget Sound, and also that our security lies not in the doctrine of nuclear weapons, but in a loving, caring God. And this is someone who was pushed out of his position because of these revolutionary and courageous words. But we actually had an archbishop at the Ground Zero Center, along with Buddhist monks and people of many other persuasions and even atheists. But we all believe in nonviolence, and I'm very honored to carry on the great traditions that began back in the mid-1970s with the theologian and author James Douglas and his wife Shelley Douglas, who together with many others founded the Ground Zero Center. So I would urge everyone to check out our Facebook page for the latest actions, if you'd ever like to join us for an action, or our website at www.gzcenter.org. And we always welcome new members.
Okay, well, Elizabeth Murray, formerly with the CIA, currently a member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, active with the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, and I'll repeat the website one more time, www.gzcenter.org. Thank you very much for talking to us on Tell Somebody.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter, @tellsomebodynow, and like the Facebook page, facebook.com/tellsomebodynow. This Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9 Central Time, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you will listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast.